Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Stephen Cook, who is the Hasib J. Sabah Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. Stephen, welcome back to our program.
Great pleasure to be back.
How long did it take you to write the book, and when did you finish it?
Well, from the time I sat down to actually write to the time I finished, the first draft was exactly a year. Obviously, I spent a lot of time beforehand doing research for the book. I finished the first draft on January 17th, 2011, 8 days before the Egyptian uprising began. But the real final product was finished by February 2011 and was published this October, past October.
What was your goal in writing the book?
Well, for me, writing is a problem-solving exercise. And my first book, Ruling But Not Governing, which I think we talked about 4 years ago, was in part about Egypt, about the military in Egypt. And I really had a lot of questions about Egypt and Egyptian politics and the U.S.-Egypt relationship coming out of that book. And I thought that it would be a terrific intellectual exercise to write a big book about Egyptian history and Egyptian politics, which would teach me the things that I thought I didn't know, and in fact I didn't know. And also, there hadn't been a book like this about Egypt for quite some time. I think in 25 years, there'd been a ton of things written on Egypt, very kind of specific academic work, tremendously useful academic work on particular aspects of Egyptian politics, but not a big book on the kind of arc about Egyptian history and politics, which is what I ended up writing in The Struggle for Egypt.
And why is it important to write this kind of history? In what way does it provide a context for what we're seeing on the news, which is what happened here?
Well, indeed, in some ways, I was quite thankful for the uprising because it provided a nice arc to my historical narrative. The whole idea behind the book is that Egypt has long been more contested in an ideologically richer place than people had given credit. Over the last decade or more, there had been this kind of two-dimensional view of Egyptian politics between the regime and the Brotherhood. But there are other groups that were out there who were engaged in politics, engaged in discussion about what ailed Egyptian society. And so I think that the book kind of pulls it all together in a historical way, that what we're seeing or what we saw on January 25th, 2011 and what we've been seeing since Mubarak's fall has historical precedent in other periods of great upheaval in Egypt, whether it's the 1919 nationalist revolution, whether it's the period before or immediately after the Free Officers' Coup in 1952, February 1968 uprising. Not many people know that Egyptian students occupied Tahrir Square for 5 days in February 1968. That was ostensibly about the light sentences that the Egyptian Air Force officers received in a trial related to their responsibility for the June 67 defeat. But in fact, what these students wanted was to live in a more democratic and open Egypt. There was a similar kind of uprising in 72. So what happened on January 25th of last year was not without precedent in Egyptian politics. And many of the themes that have come out over the course of the last year are themes that have animated Egyptian politics for the better part of the last century, if not more.
And what would you say are the central themes? I will walk you through, you know, the different actors in a few minutes. But what are the central themes that emerged after you went back and did this history?
Social justice, more representative government, and freedom from foreign domination. And I think that those things were important in the late 19th and early 20th century and remained important at the beginning of the 21st century. Egyptians didn't rise up because any country occupied them, but the U.S.-Egypt relationship was one that many Egyptians were quite uncomfortable with. In terms of social justice, the social contract between Egyptians and the Egyptian government was frayed, if not torn asunder, by the time of the late Mubarak period. And certainly Egypt was not, did not feature a representative government. So all of these things, these struggles for these, to achieve these goals are as relevant today as they were 100 or so years ago.
What surprised you most as you went back and looked at this history?
Well, indeed, what surprised me most were the parallels, with that these themes lived on, that the questions that Egyptians have been asking, the kind of key identity questions that Egyptians have been asking for a long time, are the same questions that they're asking now and that have not been, that have not to date been resolved. And I think it's important for Egyptians to answer questions about what kind of society they want, what kind of government they want, what Egypt's place is in the region, what it stands for. They have to answer those questions in order to have a more stable political system, one that, that there is general agreement about.
As I read the book, I jotted in my notes, the more things change, the more they remain the same. So this is a story about stagnation, inertia, stasis. Is that a fair reading?
Well, in one sense it is, in that the free officers regime, which is essentially the same regime that President Mubarak presided over until last February, ceased to be dynamic. And what Mubarak and the military, which is now in control of Egypt, became defenders of an increasingly illegitimate status quo. So the regime itself remained essentially the same. Of course, there were some critical changes and so on and so forth, but Egypt had stagnated. But the politics were very dynamic. This is a society that was has been mobilized and that people were searching for answers to those identity questions that I just enumerated, that were looking for a different vision of Egyptian society, a different formulation for what kind of government Egyptians should have. So there was a rather robust debate going on under this authoritarian system about the kind of Egypt that Egyptians want. What they definitely didn't want any longer was Mubarak's Egypt, or the Egypt of the free officers.
Talk about the free officers' ouster of the previous regime. They're taking a power, and the reasons you see that their revolution, in quotes, never took off.
Well, the free officers came to power in July 1952 through a coup d'etat, ostensibly because they were repulsed by the corruption of the monarchy, the foreign domination in the form of the British occupation and subsequent continued influence over Egyptian politics, and the fact that there was no social justice. Although the free officers, many of them were middle or even of upper middle class origins, they created this myth about being from kind of more hardscrabble, modest backgrounds. But in truth, when they came to power, they didn't really have an idea about how to go about doing this. They sort of made it up as they went along. And at first, they talked about a reform of the system. And then when they couldn't get other important political actors, the Muslim Brotherhood at the time, or Labor, or the existing political parties at the time, to kind of go along with them, they started talking more about creating a new regime. And in that sense, it was ultimately a revolution in that they undermined both the political and social institutions of the monarchy. But again, they created something new that was in response to the opposition that they encountered, an authoritarian political system that lacked in many ways, except for a short period of time, social justice or the kind of international influence and power that Egyptians had sought and believed was their natural right as the inheritors of a great civilization. Egypt was no more of democracy under the free officers and Nasser than it was under King Farouk and the monarchy.
What is your sense of why Egypt never took off, after the officers' revolt? Was it a lack of ideology? Was it the opposition in the society was too entrenched? Was it the remnants of tribal and family loyalties?
Well, in one way, if you look at it one way and you look at one period of time, roughly between the nationalization of the Suez Canal in 1956 and the June 67 war, the free officers of Egypt did take off. Nasserism, the principles of Nasserism, and the objective reality that many Egyptians were experiencing were pretty close. There was expanded economic opportunity, expanded educational opportunity, a sense of Egypt's important place in the world. Nasser was an important figure in the non-aligned movement, and Egyptian foreign policy at the time was referred to as positive neutralism, which the Egyptians tried to play the great powers off of each other to get the things that it wanted. Of course, there was always this lacking sense of representative government was lacking, but on other critical axes of what Egyptians wanted, it seemed that Nasserism was delivering. And then came the 67 defeat, which revealed the regime's claims actually to be quite hollow. Egypt was not a powerful country. It was smashed really not in 6 days. It was 3 days when the Israelis appeared on the east bank of the Suez Canal. Egyptians were being asked to give up personal and political freedoms, which they had wanted for a regime that wasn't necessarily delivering. That led ultimately to skip a few years after Nasser's death in 1970, to the Sadat period. And Sadat tried to correct what he believed to be the mistakes or the excesses of the Nasser period. And he talked about a state of institutions, which was code for a more democratic Egypt. He pursued economic reform, what people refer to in Arabic as infitah, economic opening. And he ultimately reoriented Egyptian foreign policy toward the West and strategic alignment with the United States. By the end of Sadat's rule, on the eve of his assassination, Egypt was not a democracy. Only the very few were prosperous. And the realignment with the United States didn't make sense in terms of Egyptian nationalism. Egyptian nationalism was a response to the domination of Egypt by the West, in particular the British. And it didn't make sense that now Sadat, only not too long after within 2 decades, was now aligning Egypt firmly with the West, in particular the United States.
This evolution from Nasser to Sadat to Mubarak leads to the creation in Egypt of a military plutocracy, really. And I noted that the military seemed more interested in contracts than battles. Talk a little about that, because that is the entrenchment of a regime that can't move beyond where it's at and try to change the society.
Well, in fact, the regime that many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Egyptians, and I'm sure it was millions of Egyptians, rose up against in January and February 2011 was the military regime that came into being in the 1950s with the free officers. They had always been a military officer at the pinnacle of the regime in the form of the president, even though there is no formal linkage between the presidency and the Egyptian armed forces. And this was a regime that was built in response to the challenges that the military confronted in the early 1950s in trying to consolidate its power. And as a result, these institutions reflected the interests of the military. And Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak, as military officers, first and foremost, thought about protecting their interests and the interests of the Egyptian armed forces. Over time, and beginning really in the 1970s, the military developed robust economic interests, and it is one of the key things that they are looking after in post Mubarak Egypt is to ensure that their well-developed economic interests remain outside the public light, and that they continue to do business as they always have done, with subsidized inputs into their businesses that help support not only the Egyptian armed forces but military officers themselves.
So we're really talking about military ink essentially a military conglomerate that owns an array of businesses and has a stranglehold on the Egyptian economy.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it a stranglehold, but there certainly are the industries and the companies that the military controls are, as I said, outside public view. They're not subject to parliamentary oversight, yet they enjoy the benefits of a range of subsidies. And, of course, they are arguably public because they are controlled by the military. Now, the Egyptian private sector has grown exponentially over the course of the last 10 or 15 years. But this big chunk of the economy remains beyond the bounds of any civilian leaders, and the military would like to keep it that way.
And what sort of products are we talking about?
Well, if you
we're
go
not
to
talking
Egypt,
just about bullets and guns,
right? If you go to Egypt, Harry, and you buy a bottle of Safi spring water, you are contributing to the military's bottom line. If Egyptians buy a certain brand of kitchen equipment, ovens, and so on and so forth, they're contributing to the military's bottom line. When your plane is fueled at an airport in Egypt, it's the likelihood is that a military-owned aviation services company is doing that refueling, and on and on and on and on. Even this big biannual military exercise that the United States and the Egyptians put on with as many as 15 or 16 other countries is a big money-making enterprise for the Egyptian armed forces.
Mm-hmm. So, during this period, what does the Egyptian military's capacity to fight wars remain at a high level?
I don't think so at all. There's no evidence that it's the Egyptian armed forces is proficient at fighting. They don't use the equipment that they have purchased from the United States with a tremendous amount of efficiency. They don't use them correctly. For example, Egyptians have M1A1 tanks, which they use as set battlefield pieces. Well, that's a waste of technology. M1A1 tanks are supposed to be for maneuver warfare, but they don't know how to service the tanks. They can't do the logistics for tanks operating over long periods of time. Egyptian military pilots are not known for their proficiency. Certainly, they can take off and they can land. But in terms of other kinds of skills, they are not as proficient as others. This is not a significant fighting force. This is a military that is involved in economics and its own economic interests and maintaining control over the Egyptian population.
So, in a way, the result of policies and relations both with the Soviet Union in the first period and then with the United States really was about putting the military to sleep, really.
Well, I wouldn't say so much during the Soviet period. Remember, during the time that the Egyptians had a Soviet-equipped military, they achieved the greatest military achievement in modern Egyptian history, the crossing of the Suez Canal in the opening phase of the October 1973 war. They didn't do so well after that heavily scripted crossing, which suggested that there were problems there in war fighting. But since then, when the United States and Egypt entered into this strategic relationship and the foreign military aid to Egypt from the United States began in the early 1980s, the goal was to make over the Egyptian armed forces into an American-equipped force, a more effective fighting force. But in fact, over the course of 35 years, essentially, the aid program has demobilized the Egyptians as a fighting force. That has had unintended consequences for Egyptian politics and the Egyptian economy, which Egyptians are experiencing right now. But it is not an effective fighting force.
And with regard to internal security during this period we're talking about, what has been the dynamic there? The military has relied on the general intelligence services to keep order when disturbances would periodically emerge?
Well, the military has always been allergic to the idea of the military itself playing a role in keeping Egypt's streets quiet. That was something that was better left in the Ministry of Interior and the Internal Security Services, the police and state security investigations. But they have been forced as a result of the uprising, and that the police having been smashed during the uprising, to take a more direct role in the policing of Egypt's streets. There is institutional rivalries between the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Interior and the General Intelligence Service. All approach internal security from a different perspective. Like I said, the Ministry of Defense doesn't really want to do this job. Otherwise, they would abolish the Ministry of Interior, which Egyptians hate because of the reputation for brutality on the part of the police and the Ministry of Interior. And the General Intelligence Service has a different function from these two other organizations.
And I read in an article, I guess, in the Financial Times, that there are 165,000 Baltagia thugs employed by the former regime. So this was an array of instruments of coercion, you would call it.
Indeed. The Ministry of Interior has what plainclothes thugs, known as the Baltagia, who were involved in trying to quell the uprising and since have been deeply involved in trying to smash the revolutionary groups and engaged in street battles with demonstrators and protesters. One of the darker episodes and periods, darker things that emerged from the use of these plainclothes thugs is the sexual harassment and sexual abuse of women during the uprising. It had previously been reserved for Egyptian women, and in particular Egyptian journalists during the 2000s, during other times of protest. We saw it during the uprising, unfortunately, happen to the CBS News correspondent Larry Logan. This is directly attributable to the Ministry of Interior and these plainclothes policemen that known as the Baltagia.
Mm-hmm. And what, as we move to the uprising in the recent period, what is this military council that has taken over? Mubarak falls from power. What is your sense of the dynamic in that group? Are all of these security agencies represented on the SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces? Who assumes leadership? Is it an institutional leadership, or is it a particular officer who rose in the way Sadat and Mubarak rose?
Well, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces existed prior to the uprising as the Supreme Council to offer its advice and views on various issues related to national security and defense policy. It has changed, obviously, since the uprising. It is made up solely of military officers. It is led by Field Marshal Tantawi, the Minister of Defense. And his deputy is Lieutenant General Sami Anan, the Chief of Staff of the Egyptian Armed Forces. That group has been largely cohesive, and there has been a unity of command. There has not been a public falling out among these officers, although just today they replaced the general in charge of propaganda and morale on the SCAF and appointed someone else. That in and of itself is not an indicator that the military is starting to crack. What the military has been concerned about, though, has been what lower ranks would do. And almost everything that they did during the uprising and since then has been to ensure that the unity of command remains and that the organization itself remains a cohesive organization. And so they will not hold responsible younger officers for outrages that happen on the streets of Egypt, like beating up young women protesters. You may have heard about the Blue Bra Girl, this woman whose clothing was ripped off, and she revealed that she was wearing a blue bra, but
beaten terribly
by the military police, because the military is concerned that they not break the armed forces in the process of administering transitional Egypt.
Is it the case now, as we read the papers, given this structure that you've outlined, that sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing?
Well, indeed. Certainly the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces holds executive authority, but it is not an evil genius collectively pulling levers and pulleys and manipulating everybody. Certainly there has been efforts to do that, but the officers have also revealed themselves to be serial bunglers, have made tremendous mistakes over the course of the last year or so. And the rivalries between the Ministry of Interior and the Ministry of Defense and the General Intelligence Service have come to the surface over the course of this last year. As much as the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces wants people to believe that they are in complete control of the country, every now and again you get a sense that, in fact, they are not, and they have not been able to move things in the direction they want, either by their own mistakes or because there is resistance. Passive resistance, but certainly resistance to what they are doing on the part of other ministries and important organizations in the Egyptian government.
Let's talk now about the evolution of the military's attitudes towards Islam and the Islamicists during this period. When we think of Nasser, we think of a secularist, basically. But by the time we move to Sadat, he's actually reaching out to the Islamicists, but trying to keep them under his control.
Well, in fact, Sadat referred to himself as the believing president and was very proud of the mark on his head called the Zabiba, which reflects in Egypt a devout Muslim who, when prostrates to pray, really presses their forehead against the ground. And it was sort of a source of pride for him and others. I would include Nasser, though, in saying that Egyptian leaders have tried to leverage religion for their own interests. Certainly Nasser did it in certain different ways than Sadat, and Mubarak did it different still. But they've all tried to manipulate religion for their own political ends, believing that they could control it in the end. Now, the armed forces itself, there is clearly a competition between the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's largest social movement and political movement, and the military. But it's not because the military is necessarily staunchly secular, like the Turkish armed forces, for example. The military in Egypt has said that it tries to run the military in along with Islamic principles. So it's not a question of religion. I think that the officers, present-day Egyptian officers, really don't believe in anything. They don't have an ideological perspective. They're looking to make a deal with whatever political group can guarantee a certain set of interests related to their economic interests and their place in the system, which is very important, that they remain the sole source of power and legitimacy and authority in the political system. But Mubarak often used the Muslim Brotherhood in ways believing that he could always control it. And when they got out of hand, he repressed them. Sadat used them to denasserize the system. Mubarak essentially outsourced social services to the Brotherhood. Most recently, Mubarak's Ministry of Interior, over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, supported, whether passively or actively, Salafist groups, believing that the Salafist groups would draw support away from the Muslim Brotherhood and that the regime would always be there to control the Salafists.
Now, when we talk about Islam in Egypt, we're really talking about a font of intellectual thinking within Islam emerging out of Egypt. On the one hand, so it's at the forefront, it seems, of intellectual developments in Islam that relate to how you deal with the modern world. On the one hand, and in its aberration, it's actually influenced intellectually the pathologies that emerged with terrorism.
Well, it's true. Egypt has always been a source, and more generally, not just religious learning, but and religious knowledge, but a source of and a center of cultural production and knowledge, and a center where great debates of Islamic reformism were had in the early 20th century. And Al-Azhar, the mosque and university, is the oldest and previously the most influential institution of Sunni Islamic learning in the world. And if you wanted to be a Sunni preacher, you would go to Al-Azhar to be trained and to learn there in Egypt, in Cairo. But it is also true that Egypt has been a font of what we've come to know as transnational jihadism. The intellectual roots for transnational jihadism were laid in Egypt in the 1960s. And Al-Qaeda is widely regarded to be a Saudi organization because of Osama bin Laden. But in fact, it was very much an Egyptian organization. The number two, Ayman Zawahiri, implicated in the murder of Anwar Sadat, and others who are important figures in Al-Qaeda, hail from Egypt. Egypt has produced a veritable all-star list of transnational terrorists.
Now, at the same time, especially the Muslim Brotherhood was really ahead of the game in political organizing, in providing social welfare. What are the roots of that? Are they in the religion, or does in part that emerge out of their relationship with the regime?
Well, the Brotherhood had an 80-year head start on many of the political parties that were vying for a seat in the People's Assembly. They have also engaged for a long time in the provision of social services for Egyptians in need, which was an effective mechanism of political mobilization. They also had, from time to time, the tolerance of a regime for its own reasons, wanting to allow the Brotherhood to take a role in these things for the regime's own political purposes, or the leaders of these regimes' political purposes. And I think just as important that the Muslim Brotherhood has a vision of Egyptian society that matters to Egyptians, that means something to Egyptians, that a positive vision of the future of Egyptian society. And the fact that it is delivered in a religious vernacular makes it important, resonates deeply with the Egyptian people. And I think in relation to their main competitors, the military, on a variety of issues like nationalism and the economy and corruption, and they score better than the military, at least from the perspective of a lot of Egyptians. So for all of those reasons, the Brotherhood, which has not handled the transition smoothly at all, but for all of those reasons, certainly had a tremendous advantage over political parties that have carried over from the Mubarak period and the myriad of new political parties that emerged after the uprising.
We have here a situation where the military regime, over the long haul, never responded to the issues of equity, social justice, which were raised again in the recent uprising. And on the other hand, the Muslim Brotherhood, with its roots in Islam, was actually responding to the failures of the system in some important way.
Well, in fact, the regimes, whether it was under Nasser or Sadat or Mubarak, failed to live up to its principles and what it was telling the people about Egypt didn't conform to the way in which Egyptians were experiencing their daily lives. And the Brotherhood has exploited that gap to tell Egyptians another story about how Egypt could be under the Brotherhood. Now, let's not be namby-pamby, though, about the Muslim Brotherhood. There are a lot of questions about the Brotherhood, and certainly their democratic credentials are not beyond reproach. To my mind, they have never repudiated their ultimate goal of Islamizing Egyptian society from below and establishing an Islamic state with Sharia as its core, Islamic law as its core, and its particular interpretation of Islamic law, which does not conform to a kind of liberal democratic political order that some hope will emerge in post-Mubarak Egypt. So I think that there is a lot for us to see going forward, whether they have in fact leveraged the language of change and reform and progressive politics for inherently anti-democratic ends, or whether the organization truly means it when they talk about political change and reform.
When you read your book, what pops up again and again is the students. So they are an important force that emerges and then sort of subsides in its influence. So what is different now, if anything, with regard to the student movement besides the technology? Obviously, the technology made an important difference in at least mobilizing for the moment, so to speak.
Well, no doubt that the technology played an important role in the instigation and mobilizing an organization. But an interesting little factoid, when the Egyptian authorities brought down the internet with the help of technology supplied by the U.S. government, Egyptian revolutionaries didn't have a means to, they weren't able to use Facebook or Twitter. So they went to another generation of student activists, the 1968 generation of student activists, and said, how did you organize? How did you build momentum without having the tools that we now have? And seeking counsel from this older generation of students who were mobilized and opposed to the regime that the Free Officers built starting in the 1950s. But I think the themes are very similar. In the aftermath of the uprising in February 1968, the pressure from the students being in the streets forced Nasser to issue the March 30 program. Which was the most important, which was a 10-point program that promised a more democratic and representative government. He never carried through. Now, what I think is different now is in part these enabling technologies and the unwillingness of these younger group of people to continue to be intimidated by the regime and represented now by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. The revolutionary groups have made a ton of mistakes since last February. But they have been right in that, one, the revolution was unfinished and that the military was not, in fact, supporting the legitimate demands of the Egyptian people, as the military claimed, but, in fact, a counter-revolutionary force.
In the end, what this all boils down to, it seems, is the failure of all of these military regimes and leaders like Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak to deal with the economy and to deal with it in a way that didn't just benefit a small group, but rather the whole society. And so now the Egyptians are confronted with an economy that's become an even greater basket case. How does that feed into the emerging power of the different actors?
Well, I'm perhaps not as Marxist as you on this. I don't think it was all about the economy. I think ideas have mattered. I think that Egyptians have been searching for social justice, more representative government, and their place in the world. And of course, social justice is in part related to economic and educational opportunities. And I think that that carries through to today. Now, the collapsing Egyptian economy and the problems that people encountered prior to the uprising certainly contributed to an environment that made this uprising possible. But first and foremost, I think it was an uprising about dignity and more representative government and democracy and those kinds of things, more than it was just about the economy. But again, now that Egyptians are confronted with a collapsing economy, I think the concern has to be that Egyptians will seek someone who can make the trains run on time, someone who promises rapid economic change rather than representative government and a more open political system. One of the battles that is going to be fought in the future in Egypt in the coming months is going to be over economic policymaking. And I think everybody agrees that the economy is collapsing, but what to do about it, whether to carry through with the kind of liberal economic reforms that Mubarak pursued over his the course of his last decade in power, or to roll that back and reinvest in the social contract, reinvest in subsidies, halt privatization, perhaps even roll back privatization, are things that Egyptians are going to debate going forward.
And help us understand the contours of the economy. You really have a youth bulge there and high unemployment among youth, 25% or so. And what percentage of the population are people under 30?
Huge number. Tremendous youth bulge. I think the three things to keep in mind about the Egyptian economy, besides the huge youth bulge, is that the Egyptian economy is dependent on three sources of revenue: Suez Canal tolls, which are down because of the global economic downturn; tourism, which is down because of the unrest and instability, uncertainty in Egypt right now; and remittances coming from Egyptian workers living in the Gulf or other parts of the world, which have not come in as quickly and at the same pace that they had previously, because even those workers in other places are concerned about all of the uncertainty in Egypt. And right now, there doesn't seem to be changes to any of those three things on the horizon. So Egyptians are going to suffer through this. Egypt has some gas, some of which it exports to Jordan and Israel. The exports to Israel are very controversial, but otherwise it is not an economic powerhouse in terms of trade.
You have a section in your book about the flawed assumptions of U.S. foreign policy for the last 30 years. Talk about that. What has been right about what the U.S. has been doing vis-a-vis Egypt, and what has been wrong, and what are we paying for now?
Well, 30 or so years ago, the United States struck a strategic relationship with Egypt for very good reasons. Egypt, being the most powerful, most influential Arab state, could be a bulwark against Soviet penetration in the Middle East. Egypt at peace with Israel would bring an end to the prospect of regional war. And Egypt, as an ally of the United States, would help make sure that no other country other than the United States dominated the Middle East, which would help the free flow of oil out of the region. And all of these things were good assumptions, but 30 years later, they didn't make as much sense as they did when that strategic relationship began. And yet we continue to operate as if that world still existed. The other, I think, flaw was how deeply involved we were in Egypt. We didn't recognize Egypt's history. In some way, we were naive in a way. We were going to help build, with this new relationship, we were going to help build a new Egypt. And we did wonderful things in terms of Egyptian infrastructure, electrification, making potable water available for people through the U.S. Agency for International Development, wonderful agricultural programs, health programs. I mean, you could go on and on and on and on. But it was also coming on the heels of another period of Egyptian empowerment where Egyptians weren't so fond of the idea of foreign domination. Now, of course, what we were doing in Egypt wasn't domination, but it was an occupation. But again, this was something that was unsettling to many Egyptians. And then, of course, the strategic alignment with the United States and the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, which is a factor in the U.S.-Egypt relationship, was seen as rendering Egypt a secondary or second-rate power in the region. Egypt was sidelined while the United States and Israel pursued their interests unfettered in the region, and this made Egyptians feel quite weak. So this is something that we didn't appreciate. We didn't appreciate that Egyptians didn't look at the treaty between Egypt and Israel in the same way that many people in other parts of the world did. They didn't see Sadat as heroic. They saw him as perhaps reckless as someone who the Israelis got the better of him in the negotiations, and that it was a shameful peace because it was a separate peace. Now, that's hard to accept from the Western narrative of this great, you know, achievement of Egypt-Israel peace, but there is a genuine feeling that it warped Egyptian foreign policy to the benefit of both the United States and Israel.
So how does the United States respond now in this transition, apparently, to a democratic Egypt? First question, did the Obama administration handle things well during the uprising?
Well, about as well as anybody could expect. This is a great Washington, D.C. parlor game question. You know, how would you grade the Obama administration's handling of the uprisings in the Arab world, but in particular in Egypt? My answer is this is hard. There's no precedent. There's no playbook. They did as best as they possibly could do. I will tell you that from the very beginning, there was a sense that this was different from other protests and that the people were going for broke and trying to bring down Mubarak. And there was really not much that the United States could do if that was truly the dynamic that was underway. In terms of what we should be doing now, my advice, if anybody were to ever ask it, is that less is actually more. That we should be mindful of our history in Egypt, or we should be mindful of the perception of our history in Egypt, which is supporting a military-dominated dictatorship that repressed its people and was brutal in the process. As a result, the United States should stick to first principles about democracy and tolerance and nonviolence and accountability and checks and balances and equal application of the law, and wait for Egyptians to ask us for something that, and do our very best to respond to those requests. We don't want to be seen as trying to manage or influence or shape the Egyptian political process. This is a moment where Egyptians feel empowered, where they want to write their own history. And quite frankly, we don't have the best street cred in Egypt these days. Unfortunately, the policy process doesn't necessarily allow for that because our own bureaucracies fight for their resources, and when they have those resources, they have to do something with them in order to justify their existence in the following year's budget. My hope is, though, that even with that, people are mindful of our history in Egypt, and that we defer to Egyptians when it comes to helping them build the new Egypt.
There's a dilemma here for a policymaker in Washington in the sense that we are advocates of democracy, but the winner, and at least in the short term, of the democratization are the groups that we are we view negatively because of their alleged link with terrorism. It's not a strong link, but I'm really talking about the debate here in the United States. So, and our efforts to bring democratization there through Republican or Democratic institutes, as we're discovering, is perceived as foreign meddling. So it's a very hard problem to get your hands on. We want to further democracy, but the winners in nascent democratic movements may be people we see as working against our interests.
Well, first, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the big winner in the Egyptian elections, doesn't really have a link to terrorism. But
I understand the perception that
people have put out, particularly in this presidential election season, and it's just not true. I do think, though, that the dilemmas that we confront here are a function of the fact that for decades we relied on non-democratic leaders to carry our water in the region, to help us pursue our interests. Now, that worked very well. We were pretty successful. But when those regimes come to an end, we're confronted with these dilemmas. And the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, and others have been steadfast in their opposition to Egypt's strategic relationship with the United States and will quite naturally seek to capitalize on this politically, which is a reason why things are going to be more complicated for the United States in the region. And one of the reasons why the United States, I think, in terms of our policy, less is more. There's really very little that we can do about this. The Egyptian people, to the extent that 52 to 60% of them voted overwhelmingly for either the Freedom and Justice Party, which is the party of the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Salafist and Nur Party. There's very little that we have at our disposal to shape the political arena in Egypt. And as a result, I think it's incumbent upon policymakers to adjust to a new reality, not to try to force some new reality on Egypt or reverse things. We don't need another operation or another operation something Egyptian. Something freedom. We don't need an operation Egyptian freedom. Not that anybody is seriously talking about that. But my point is just that our ability to drive events and shape the events in this part of the world is actually rather limited, and so that we need to recognize the reality for what it is and adjust our approach to these countries accordingly.
As you look to the future, what do you see issues that we should be concerned about as the Egyptian people make their own history and define the outcome of what you call the struggle for Egypt?
Well, I think there's three things. One is the handover of power from the military to civilians, which is supposed to happen in June, July of 2012. We'll see how that goes. We'll tell us something about the trajectory of Egyptian politics. And then two other things which are related, which is the constitution writing process, which is supposed to begin relatively soon and take place over the course of 6 months. How that unfolds, and importantly, how Egyptians try to answer those important questions about their identity, about what kind of government they want, what kind of society they want, what the relationship is between a citizen and their state, Egypt's place in the world, what it stands for in that process. Those are the most important antecedent questions. The quality of elections won't matter, or whether they hold elections or not, until Egyptians agree on the answers to those questions and some others. And I think that those three things, although two are related, are really markers for observers to get a sense of the direction that Egypt is moving.
What do you think outside actors should do with regard to the Egyptian economy? Because during this period, it seems to be critical for the success, you know, of whatever group within Egypt winds up ruling in an Egyptian democracy.
Well, to the extent that anybody has any money left, I think that they should continue to invest in Egypt. The United States is the largest investor in Egypt, although it's not a huge amount. The Turks have been very active throughout the region and are looking for opportunities in Egypt. And then Americans should go to Egypt. It's you would think from the news reports that this was Cairo in particular was a city at war with itself. It's not the case. And one of the great things that people can do to help Egypt is to go and enjoy Egypt and the amazing sights. Egypt is the inheritor. Modern day Egyptians are the inheritors of a great civilization. There's still the pyramids of Giza, the Step Pyramid of Saara, the Valley of the Kings, Karnak, Abu Simbel. These things are all there waiting to be discovered by tourists who can spend their money in Egypt and help. There are a lot of Egyptians who've been thrown out of work because there aren't the millions and millions of tourists visiting the country as a result of the uprising and the subsequent instability and uncertainty.
Now, looking back at the origins of your book, you chose to go back and do a political history, and then history delivered an interesting phenomena at the same time. What from your journey do you learn about answering this question, which is how would you like what you found in this book have an impact on policy in the sense, are the insights that you drew that you think would be helpful for the American dialogue on this?
Well, you know, all too often in Washington, these policy debates happen in a historical vacuum. And what I would very much like to come out of the struggle for Egypt is for the ability of people, when they have these debates, to place them in the proper historical perspective. And that if we did have we did have a longer view of Egyptian politics and paid more attention to what Egyptians were saying and what they wanted, we may have a better policy. You can only have – your policy is only as good as your assumptions are, and your assumptions should be informed by a rigorous history and a correct reading of the country. And I think all too often these conversations happen and we're shooting from the hip. Last spring, I was privy to a conversation, mostly of outside experts, in which the kind of dominant theme was, we have to get Egypt right. How is Egypt ours to get right? It's almost as if Egyptians have no agency, no ability to calculate their own interests, that somehow they need our help. Well, if the uprising should teach us anything, they certainly don't need our help. They have the means within themselves to change the course of their own history, and they should be able to do that without our interference only when they ask for it. That's what I'd like people to get out of it.
Well, Stephen, on that note, let me show your book again, The Struggle for Egypt, a good book and an important read at this critical time in Egypt's history. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.